I have a very pressing question to ask you.
Okay.
If you open up a bag of chips and you grab some chips from it, and one of them happens to be green around the edges, do you eat the green chip?
No.
Do you eat any of the other chips?
Yes.
Do you eat the chip that was green up to the green part?
No.
Why don't you eat the green chip?
Because it'll probably taste bad.
I just had some chips, and one of them had a little bit of green on it, and I was like, meh. It tasted fine. It tasted like salt, because that's what chips are.
Sure. Have you ever made chips?
Like, sliced potatoes very thinly and put them in the oven and baked them. I've done that.
Okay. That is a way of making chips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, not like the kind you would get in a bag. Have you made chips?
I mean, yeah, I don't know that they're the kind that you'd get in a bag because they were a lot less salty, but, you know, sliced up a potato with a mandolin, threw it in a deep fryer.
Yeah, deep fryer is that's the key.
Yes.
Nobody wants those baked chips.
I mean, other than all of the people who buy baked chips.
Lays.
Yeah. I was trying to avoid using brand names on the show, Derek.
Since they haven't paid for placement.
Exactly.
Or have they? Is this all a Baked Lays advertisement? But anyway, if I come down ill in the next few days, it's because I ate that green chip.
Okay.
I figure it's just penicillin. It's all right.
Was somebody giving you crap about eating the green chip?
No, I was just thinking about it. I was like, you know, I regularly kind of like, if it's just a little bit of green on a chip, I'm just like, meh, it's fine.
Yeah, no, it's just, it could taste bitter.
Okay. Well, I guess, you know, science. We're doing science. Not really. We're doing about as much science as we do engineering. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Derek.
How's it going?
It's going all right.
How was your RailsConf?
RailsConf was good. You know, the onesies and the stickers were very popular, so I was pleased.
That's a sign of a successful conference. How many stickers can you give away?
Yes. I don't know. I realized afterwards, I'm like, I'm that guy who, when the family goes on a family vacation, gets like Griffin Family Vacation 2017 t-shirts made.
Griffin University.
Everyone to wear them.
And then gives out stickers that say Griffin Family Vacation to everybody else who's not a Griffin.
Exactly. No, but come on. Those baby Ruby stickers are so cute.
They are pretty good. We'll have to post a picture of them in the show notes for people that weren't there. And then they can request that you somehow get them some.
Yeah. Once I'm back in America, I will happily mail out stickers, but mail them to you from Canada. Unless you're in Canada. If you're in Canada and would like a sticker, let me know. If you're not, it would be unreasonably expensive for me to mail them.
A Canadian citizen can send mail, or a Canadian, somebody living in Canada, as they call it, can send mail to somebody else in Canada with like one of those inner office envelopes, right? Like there's no, you just write their name on it, stick it in a box, and it gets there.
Really?
No, I have no idea. I'm just kidding. It's a bad joke. yeah, RailsConf was good.
How'd you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it, actually. Like, I got to do my talk first and got that over with, and it was well-received. Better received than I thought it would be, which isn't to say I thought it would not be received well, but the feedback was pretty good.
I mean, some people were really disappointed that you just couldn't come up with random names for things on the spot.
Yeah, the video might be up. If the video is up by the time we release this episode, I'll post a link to it in the show notes. If not, then I don't know. I'll tweet it out when it comes out so you can follow me on Twitter. But in the question and answer thing, I talked about REST, and in the question and answer thing, people were just asking me like what I would name resources that do X, which I should have seen coming, but it's kind of hard to do in 5 seconds flat with no context.
Right.
And like, so that
part's one of those you spend 10 minutes thinking about it and come up with a good name. Not being able to come up with a good name instantly on the spot on stage does not disprove the point.
But yeah, anyway, it was a good conference. And then once I got it over with, I was actually able to, like, the next day we focused a lot on the podcast, but I still like met a whole bunch of people. If I met you at RailsConf and you came up and you said you like the show or some open source stuff that I do, that was totally awesome. And I did get to meet a number of people that we've interacted with just through Twitter and things like that on the show before. And that was really cool to do that and see some of their talks and such.
What was your favorite talk?
I mean, I like Justin Searles' keynote on the second day, was it? Beginning of the second day, end of the second day, something like that. I liked that. I liked Eileen's talk on system tests and Rails because it gave me ideas. And I actually ended up spending a little bit of time with Sam at the exhibition. What do they call those things?
The exhibition the
showroom,
hall.
Yeah, the exhibition hall. At the showroom floor, we kind of pulled up some couch
on the
space.
Tilda couch.
Yeah, on the Tilda couch and or the skylight couch, and started hacking on trying to get that to work in RSpec. So that was cool. I don't know. There were lots of I like kind of soaking it all in, and mostly I just like meeting the people. And this year I think made the smart decision to take it easy on like nighttime activities, and just like the most I did was like go out for dinner, and then I went back and either just hung out in the lobby for a little bit and went to bed, or just went straight to bed.
Yeah,
and it was fine. It was great. I had plenty of energy during the day to talk to people, and it's always interesting that last day. I think everybody's kind of like, last day. Everybody's kind of like, you again.
But RailsConf is definitely a bit on the long side.
Yeah, I feel like it used to be even longer. I feel like there were years where it was 4 days long.
Probably. But I mean, most regional conferences don't go for, a lot of them are single day. Mm-hmm. Most of them are not more than 2 day, which is a, 1 day almost always feels too short. 2 days feels like it's a little bit too short.
3 days is fine. It's fine. You just have to recognize it's going to be, kind of pace yourself.
Yeah.
You know, if you have difficulty like meeting and talking to new people, it can be really exhausting.
Yeah, definitely.
But thanks for introducing yourself to us folks. And it was awesome to see everybody there.
I was really pleased, at least from the talks that I saw. There were just a lot of like first time speakers who gave really solid talks and didn't fall into all of the first time speaker pitfalls. Mm-hmm. I feel like we had a higher average quality level per presentation overall, but we didn't have as many speakers this year who were like the ridiculously huge names, like, oh, sucks to be anybody up in a slot against them, which I'm happy, because like I always feel bad for everybody who's up against those people.
Yeah. And I definitely did, like, I mean, I knew some of the people who were speaking in my slot, but I also wasn't like, oh, Sandy Metz is speaking alongside right. the thing, which was nice. And yeah, not to say anything bad about Sandy, but I feel like Sandy should be exclusively keynote material at this point.
Yeah.
Because you can't put her talk up against anybody else's and hope that people go to the other things. But she didn't speak there this year. So, you know, there were lots of new speakers. And like, I didn't go on Wednesday. I didn't get an opportunity to go to a lot of talks because we were recording basically all day.
Yep.
With various people, episodes that you will hear kind of spaced throughout the next several weeks, I imagine.
Potentially you've already heard one when this comes out.
Yeah, we're not sure.
Depending on how we end up releasing them.
But I did get a chance to like kind of like fly by some rooms, like when we were between things. I would just be like, oh, I'm going to go check out this one. And like there was one, I can't remember specifically, so if this is your talk, I'm sorry. But like there was one on React that I kind of like sat in the doorway for about 10 minutes. And I was like, oh, this is going well. Like, this person's very clearly prepared and doing a great job. And then, like, I don't know, various other things. I've started to watch. I did miss Alex's talk on contributing to Rails.
Which involved, like, a two-minute talk portion about your pull request.
Which I felt bad because I had committed to seeing, like, two different things at the same time. Like, I wanted to go see that because I'd interacted with Alex a couple times. Not because I knew he was going to mention my name, but because I'd interacted with him a couple times and been like, oh, he's a nice person. I should go see his talk because I am available at that time. But then I also told other people that I would see their talk at the same exact time. And it just so happened that I passed the other person's room first and was like, oh, I guess I'll go here. but I did watch that. Like, some of the videos are starting to trickle out, and I did watch the video and stuff. So if you asked me to see your talk and I wasn't able to see your talk, because there were a couple people that asked us to go see their talks, I will definitely watch the video of it and let you know what I thought.
Yeah.
Cool. What have you been working on since RailsConf?
Diesel.
Yeah?
And baby. But the last 2 days, Diesel.
Put the baby aside.
Put the baby aside. Should probably go feed her at some point.
Hmm.
She's probably hungry at this point. It's been about 2 days. No, it's actually been really weird watching, because I just haven't had time for open source much lately. And so it's been weird, like, I'll occasionally, you know, open up my Gitter client and be like, ah, there are 200 unread messages in the Diesel Gitter. Let me start going through these. And then they've all been handled. And yeah. Like, the other contributors are fixing bugs and working on new features. And like, it's just sort of chugging along without me. And it's kind of like weird to see the project do that, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I've obviously been a part of projects that do that, but I've never created one from the ground up that actually like persisted, you know, had people interested in maintaining it beyond my involvement.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
which is nice because it's let me, when I do have time to work on it, I'm able to focus more on some of the deeper refactorings I've been wanting to do for ages, but haven't had time to because, like, oh my God, I need to address X, Y, and Z issues. And so one of the things I'm working on right now is figuring out how to make multi-table joins work. And then the big one that I've been working on the last 2 days, though, was reworking how we handle all the passes we do over our AST to be more traditionally structured.
Why does it matter to be traditionally structured?
It makes it easier to add new AST passes, and also for people who are familiar with compilers or just AST visitors to contribute to the code base. So we have three-ish main passes that we do. We have the toSQL pass, which is just, you know, give me the SQL. We have is saved cache as prepared statement, where we go determine if the AST contains any nodes, where that's the existence of that node indicates the existence of a potentially unbounded number of SQL queries, which means that, like, we don't put an upper limit on the size of the prepared statement cache. It's bounded to the number of queries that you execute in your application, and we just avoid doing it for things that generate an unbounded number of queries. So in SQL literal nodes, because I have no way of knowing if that literal SQL was constructed dynamically or not, anything that is an insert or update statement, there's technically a handful of insert statements that we could cache, but it's just not worth it. Right. And then in the general case, insert and update statements are unbound. The number of queries they can generate is the number of fields being set, potentially factorial, which that is technically bounded, but it's a pretty large upper bound. So we avoid that. And then batch insert, of course, is unbounded. Those are the main ones. And then the last pass that we do is collect all the bind parameters, because you have to do that at some point.
Right.
So the first pass, we actually skip most of the time. I guess we technically have a fourth AST pass, but it's not really implemented as an AST pass. It's implemented as a, like, this is just always a compile time constant, which the other ones mostly are, modulo some things with boxing and type erasure. But the last one we do is this query uniquely identified by its type, which is basically yes unless it's boxed or contains a SQL literal node. Those are basically the only two types, which where the query, the SQL that's generated cannot be uniquely identified by the type, and then insert and update as well. And in, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Box, though, is the one case where it's potentially safe to cache, but it is never uniquely identifiable by its type. And so that determines whether in our prepared statement cache, whether we just use the type ID, so we just know what the query is, or whether we go through the query builder every time and then hash the SQL string to find the prepared statement.
What do you mean by boxed?
So basically, hidden behind a pointer.
Okay.
And the reason that you would do that with Diesel in particular is because you don't want the query to be uniquely identified by its type. Because if you have a variable X, X has a specific type.
Okay.
You can't assign it a new value. You can rebind X. You can do like let X equal something else, but you can't like conditionally assign X to something that is of a different type.
Okay.
So if you wanted to conditionally say if this query parameter is present in the request params, add this filter. Or add this where clause to the query, right? That would normally change the type of the query.
Okay.
So you wouldn't be able to be like, let query equals, you know, users table if params Q filter right. Search equals whatever. So what you do is you box it so that way the type is some query where we've erased all of the information we know about it other than the table it's coming from, the SQL type of the select clause, and the database you are planning on executing it against. Because those are the things that we need to verify the validity of any future calls that you make, but then we don't know the specific types of everything inside of it. So rather than like, we know the value of this type, which means we know where the function is, instead the data is stored behind what's called a fat pointer. So it's a pointer to the data and then a pointer to the V table, which includes the location of all the functions that it calls. So it does all of that at runtime rather than at compile time, which means that the query builder basically is twice as slow in those cases, because the optimizer just can't optimize as many things.
Right.
And then also we have to go through the query builder every time you want to execute it, because we need to get the SQL string to look it up in the prepared statement cache. So unless a query is boxed, we almost never run the toSQL pass. We basically run that exactly once when we populate the prepared statement cache. But we do, for every execution of the query, run the other two AST passes, the determining if it's safe to cache the prepared statement. And actually, we don't I just realized we can there's no point in skipping that AST pass because unless the query is boxed, it's a free AST pass. But technically, we could check to see if it's in the cache before we check if it's safe to cache. Right now, we check to see if it's safe to cache and then go see if it's in the cache.
Mm-hmm.
But we definitely always run the collect bind parameters AST pass because, like, we just have to. So right now, the way that is implemented is just we have a trait, which is like an interface in Java, and it has three methods on it. One called toSQL, one called collect binds, and one called is safe to cache repaired.
Mm-hmm.
And other than toSQL, the implementation of the other two methods is incredibly boring on almost every single type. It's basically always implemented as call this method on each of my fields and return some combination of those.
Yep.
So that means it just is incredibly painful and tedious if I want to add a new AST pass, which there was one that I wanted to add yesterday morning, which is why I went down and decided to just finally do this refactoring. I don't remember what the AST pass I wanted to add was, which is annoying because I finished the refactoring and now I don't remember why I did it. But just because I have to implement this method for every single node in our AST.
Mm-hmm.
And the implementation is incredibly boring in almost all cases. And that's just because, like, I didn't implement it in a traditional AST fashion where we use effectively the visitor pattern. So it's very easy for me to add new data types because it just has to implement these three methods, but it's very difficult for me to add new functions over all of those data types. Right. This is sort of right one of the classical computer science problems that you have a set of types and you have a set of functions and you want to be able to add both new functions and new types and have that be done easily and cleanly. A lot of people also add the constraint of without recompiling existing code, which I think is kind of a silly constraint and not really the point of the problem. But
so what you wanted was a framework where you have this pattern for visiting all of these AST nodes and then you run these functions on them. And that's not what you have currently.
Right. I want to have the single function that they implement, which is here's how to traverse the AST.
Right.
And then at the leaf nodes have whatever interesting behavior there.
Right.
So typically one would do that with the visitor pattern. And there's sort of like different levels of visitoriness that you can go on how full on you go with the visitor pattern. Like you can go full textbook Java enterprise patterns visitor pattern, right, where you have visit for every possible data type, and it's incredibly painful to add new data types because you have to enumerate over it for every single AST pass on your visitor itself. Or represent it as visit object or whatever superclass you have. I didn't really want to go that route. The level I was looking to go towards was have an AST visitor trait, which would have all of the various methods that were needed for each of my AST passes on it. And the implementation of those methods would default to a no-op. And so I would fill in the implementation of those methods on the AST visitors that mattered.
Right.
Now, the issue with that came down to what in Rust is known as a problem of object safety. So this is sort of just a trade-off that in other languages is implicitly made for you, but Rust is making the performance trade-offs explicit. So what's important is that this query fragment, the trait that represents a thing that is a member of our AST, it needs to be object safe. So I need to be able to put it in a box and call all of the methods on it. So there are basically three restrictions to that. The first is that I can't have generic functions in it because when you box it, right, you have to have a pointer to each of the methods provided by that trait. If a function is generic, there are potentially unlimited number of instantiations for all possible data types that get passed in there. You can't have that. You can't represent that as a single function. The way you work around that is typically by whatever the thing that you were trying to be generic over, you also box that.
Okay.
So that way now you're not taking type T where T implements some trait. You're taking a value that is known to implement T, but the exact implementation and type are hidden behind a pointer. Then the other two restrictions that are less important for this context are you can't take self by value because you don't know how big self is or what the type of self is. And then you can't have any methods that don't take, you can't have class methods, basically. You can only have instance methods because otherwise you don't know. Again, you can never really reference the type of self. Yep. Because you don't know what type self is.
Yep.
So to make query fragment object safe, I would have to have a version that took a pointer to an AST visitor, which would mean AST visitor would have to be object safe. An AST visitor would have to have this toSQL function, which is given the type of the data and the SQL type that we are trying to bind it to, and the backend that we're working against figure out what bytes we need and generate those so that we can send them down the wire. And that method in particular is one that cannot be made object safe. It needs to be generic. I cannot make it not be generic without absurd performance penalties and difficulties that bubbled elsewhere in the library. And I actually used to have it set up in a way that was object safe a long, long, long time ago back in 0.1, and it was painful as all hell, which is why I got rid of it. But I'd forgotten about that until I tried to do that, so that didn't work at all. So what I end up with is this kind of funky situation where I'm representing my AST passes as an enum. So basically, it has most of the benefits of the visitor pattern, but I couldn't have new AST passes added by third-party crates.
Okay.
It has to be this closed set of known AST passes. So it's easy for Diesel to add new AST passes, which is really the main benefit that I care about here, because this is, you know, our internals. But it's still just kind of funky. And I've been very closely looking at the generated assembly as I've been going through this refactoring.
Okay.
Just because, like...
As you do.
As one does, yeah. No, because I'm concerned, because ultimately what this means is... And this performance implication is going to be true for box queries no matter what, but that's just going to happen. But the performance implications end up being, to a certain extent, a bunch of conditionals of, if we're doing this pass, do this behavior. If we're doing this pass, do this behavior. If we're doing this pass, do this behavior. As opposed to just do this behavior, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? All of those checks and branches could potentially add some cost. Now, ideally, what happens is the optimizer inlines all these functions together and then sees, okay, we constructed the value to be this AST pass. We know for sure which of the variants of this enum we have. Eliminate all of the conditionals and go back to essentially the generated assembly that we had before, which seems to mostly be holding up. Although I think I'm going to have to put some annotations in a few places where a function would not normally be inlined because it's too large. And tell the compiler, no, actually, always inline this function, please, because I'm relying on you doing that to eliminate a large number of instructions.
Right.
Because even just some benchmarking, like on some really naive passes, just with all of our tiny little AST nodes, even when their implementation for various passes is a no-op, and even if we can prove it's a no-op for a given call, if the function call itself isn't inline, just saving all of the registers that are potentially manipulated ends up adding up in terms of time. This level of performance stuff is usually only measurable on the SQLite benchmarks for like queries that are returning very small number of records.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I care about that use case, so... It's good. I mean, my main goal there is just for arbitrarily complex queries, trying to keep the query builder sub-microsecond, which we're more or less at. Again, not necessarily true for boxed queries, but boxed queries seem to top out at about 2 microseconds, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
Boxed queries will, of course, always grow linearly with the number of nodes in that AST. There's no way around that. At that point, I'm walking to ARL AST, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know, it was just an interesting... kind of exercise, and I end up with something that, you know, I certainly other people have done it that way, and I'm would assume that people who are more educated in traditional computer science than I am would look at what I came up with and see it as a huge anti-pattern, which is probably the case. But I end up with something that I don't often see in the wild, and I've been spending a few days thinking about it and have not come up with a better direction to take it, just given the constraints that I have to work within, both in terms of type safety and performance. So
you started this by saying you wanted to make something a little more familiar, and you're still...
It's more familiar than what we had before.
Okay.
Or if nothing else, it's easier for me to add new passes, which when I remember whatever the hell AST pass I wanted to add yesterday will be very useful to me.
Well, and you also mentioned at one point the solution, I don't remember if that's the solution ended up landing on, but the solution would be that it'd be easy for Diesel to add... additional passes, but crates would not be able to. Like, what would a crate want to do to add? What kind of thing do you think a crate would want to do? And I guess if you could remember this, you'd be able to remember the thing that...
No, I mean, the reason a crate might want to do this is if there's some important... Like, okay, here's an example. Well, you'd want to prove this in the type system with Diesel, but I guess maybe not. Okay, so SQL Server requires that you have an order by clause.
Okay.
So
SQL Server requires that queries have an order by clause?
Yeah.
Wow. How did I not know that? I feel like I would have
known you,
that.
You have to provide a consistent ordering for SQL Server. Or maybe that's only if you're using limit and offset. I'm pretty sure it requires it all of the time, but I could be mistaken. anyway, one could, in theory, with Diesel, you'd probably want to do this more at the type level, but ignoring that, like, just as a spitballing for a random example, they could theoretically want to add a new AST pass, which is, hey, does this contain an order by clause? And then, if not, add one.
Okay.
That's like that specific use case probably would be a terrible actual example, but just off of like as the example that sounds kind of reasonable to prove that maybe it exists. Again, it's a very it was a very secondary concern.
Is that what I'm guessing you probably don't know this offhand, but is that like what the SQL Server driver for Rails is probably doing, like adding an order by if it's not there already? Oh, I guess Rails already does that as a default.
No, Rails does not.
I thought it did. I thought it ordered by ID now.
We did for one version and then immediately reverted it because it messes with indexes on every other driver.
Oh, all right.
Some methods will automatically add ID.
Like if you call first. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, the SQL Server driver is doing exactly that. It's looking to see if there's an order by clause and then adding one if it's not present.
Interesting. I wrote things against SQL Server all the time. I don't remember that, but you know, it was a long time ago. Cool.
Anyway, that's been my 2 days.
How do you think you're just going to commit to this? Well, it's weird, but we're going with it.
Yeah, I mean,
cool.
I finished the bulk of the refactoring. The last thing I want to do is we have actually, so I said 3-ish passes because we also have two other traits, which are like all of the AST passes from the first trait, sometimes with an additional tiny one, and also it's slightly different because it's like, oh, but for insert I need to be able to, you know, I have this thing and I need to be able to get the list of columns that it's referencing, but that's dependent on the value, so I need a different trait for that. Or with update, it's because I use column dot my EQ node, which is normally used for quality, mm-hmm. but I wanted the syntax to look the same, so you know, column name dot EQ value, the column name cannot be qualified when it appears in the set portion of an update statement. So like I have my separate version of this trait, which is basically the same trait, but for update SQL, which is literally just overridden by EQ to specifically when the ensure only the left side can only be a column and to not quote the column name,
right.
Which like I need to add. Part of what will be nice about this is once I merge my branch where I moved the two SQL paths into this new structure, I can just very easily add on an additional context parameter,
mm-hmm.
which is carried by that pass, but only by that pass. But I won't have to then go edit every single AST node to add this additional function parameter.
Right.
That's then just passed through blindly. So then I can have the column list context and do not quote column names context and whatever else, which is important because like, we don't support expression indexes in Postgres right now for upsert mm-hmm. because when you reference a column in an index, you cannot qualify the column name. And when you're referencing an expression index as an upsert target, that string has to exactly match whatever the whatever you told Postgres it was when you created the index. And I didn't want to go create a new trait that was like, to SQL for expression indexes and implement that for every single goddamn node in the AST. But now with this, it'll be much easier for me to just like in my on conflict target node, or I guess I'd have a new node on expression, and then just there when it passes the AST pass down, just change the context to be don't quote column names.
Yeah,
or don't qualify column names.
Well, that discussion reminded me of two things. A, SQL inserts are weird. It's just so different than the syntax that you would think that they would be.
Yep.
I would do like insert new record into table name set. And it would be.
That's the main thing, is having it be consistent with update syntax.
Right. Instead of like, here's a list of columns and then separately, here's a list of values, and then having to look at them and be like, oh, wait, I transposed the order of these two things. So now I'm going to be inserting the wrong thing here. I don't know. It's ridiculous. And the second thing is, as I've been on more projects that have a more up-to-date version of Postgres, I find myself using upsert more and being like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Upsert is awesome.
Upsert solves so many problems.
Yeah.
So same with window functions. Like, those are the two features I've been abusing the hell out of upsert and window functions.
I feel like I got to get more. We've been doing these things in the Boston office, like maybe once a month or so, called, we're calling them lunch and learns. And it's, we invite developers from another company in Boston. They come and like one of their developers will give a talk and then one of our developers will give a talk. And Joe Ferris today gave a talk about Spark, which is like a data processing kind of thing by Apache. And in it, he made use of several window functions to do cool things. And I was like, I got to get a better handle on these. But then I think the biggest
use case for them for the majority of Rails devs is just, hey, you have that query that's paginated. You know how you're doing two queries, one to get the value and one to get the total count? With window functions, you don't have to. Count star over open paren, close paren. Bam. One query includes the total.
Somebody make a gem that lets us do that. Oh, and the other thing, the folks we had in today were from Maxwell Health, which is a company in Boston, and they do a lot of Scala stuff, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, they gave a talk about GraphQL and how they're using it. And it's like the second time I've talked to people who have been using GraphQL. And the more I see of it, the more I'm like, yeah, this would be awesome for any actual API.
Yeah, just not implementing it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they showed consuming it again, some more consuming it, and I was like, this is awesome. And we asked questions about, like, what's it like from the implementing side, and the answer we got was, like, I think it depends on where you're implementing it and what the tooling's like for those languages already. So I'm more curious to play with some of that stuff. I want to see it. And it was kind of funny as somebody who just gave a talk all about how REST is awesome. But it wasn't really about how REST was awesome. It was more about how, like, thinking in that way keeps you from doing terrible things in your Rails app. And that was the secret of the talk. So I don't feel bad about then saying, actually, GraphQL is really cool. Let's see how that works out.
I mean, it also just depends on who's consuming what.
Right. And like, to be honest, the target of the talk I was giving, and I said this in the beginning, is that, like, most of the people in that room are probably working on one monolithic Rails app, right?
Right.
So, like, the API side concerns of a RESTful API are not particularly interesting. Like, the whole, I don't know.
Right. I mean, it's potentially, right, it's the server-rendered web app and then maybe a mobile app that consumes the same API.
Right, right. But yeah, anyway, GraphQL, we're gonna have to dig into this at some point. I feel like we're going to have a GraphQL episode.
Didn't we already have a GraphQL episode?
We talked about GraphQL when we had Chris on to talk about Tell Me When It Closes, because they use GraphQL.
Is that not enough of a GraphQL
episode? No, we need somebody to implement a GraphQL and then talk about that.
All right.
We consumed GraphQL.
I'll open an issue to implement GraphQL on crates.io, and I'll let you know how that goes.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, this is my typical MO, as I want something done in the world, I talk about it on the podcast, and then somebody else more motivated than I does it. So,
right.
All right, let's wrap up.
Yeah.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/110.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about this episode or any of our other episodes, you can tweet us @_bikeshed, email us @host@bikeshed.fm, or leave a comment on our website.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time. Hey, also, smarter people who know more about traditional AST implementations than I do, the links to the pull requests are in the show notes. Come comment on how terrible my design is. Thanks.